All right, so we'll go ahead and call the next matter then. I believe we'll take a break then after that. This is 5-25-0372. This is Roger Matea versus Bruce Matea et al. And for the appellant, we have Mr. Gruninger. And for the appellee, we have several attorneys, and it looks like Mr. Skegan will be arguing today. All right, so are you both prepared to proceed? All right. Go ahead and get settled in, and when you're ready then, Mr. Gruninger, you may approach the microphone and state your name, and you may proceed.
Daniel J. Gruninger for the appellant, Bruce Matea. May it please the court, opposing counsel. The first issue I'm going to take up is the last one that's in the brief. That has to do with disqualification of the opposing attorney, Attorney Sprague, in the case. There is a standard that was enunciated in a case called Schwartz v. Cordelloni, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case from 1997. And that standard requires, in accordance with the cases that came afterward, to include in re estate of Clem. That case requires a balancing test, so to speak. I want to first point to Judge Katz's conclusions in the case. She stated that she believed that it required necessity. There is two competing interests, however. Absolutely necessary is only half the equation. In re estate of Clem goes into the other half of the equation. It states on page 829 of the opinion, it states that the absolutely necessary, while that is part of the equation, because it says it is well settled that since disqualification serves to destroy the attorney-client relationship from freely retaining counsel of his choice, it's regarded as a drastic measure that courts should apply only when absolutely necessary. While that is true, it states above that, however, courts have vital interests in protecting the attorney-client relationship, maintaining public confidence in the legal profession, and ensuring the integrity of judicial proceedings. So those are competing interests that the court is supposed to weigh with respect to this. Now, the tests are laid out in the brief that I filed, and I won't go through all of them, but I do want to address some of the pieces of those tests. The standard is a substantial connection, a substantial relationship between the prior litigation and the current litigation. In this case, the prior litigation that that Robert Sprague was involved in on behalf of Bruce was for a post-judgment action regarding non-minor education expenses. As this court well knows, under Section 513 of the IMDMA, non-minor education expenses can be ordered to be paid through either the income or through the assets of an individual. Those assets that Bruce was involved in and thence Attorney Sprague was involved in involved some things that he would anticipate inheriting from his mother. So the question in the post-divorce matter, the non-minor education expense matter, was some of them were in Bruce's name, some of them were in his mother's name, and then what was the relationship between the two of them? And one of the things that Judge Katz addresses in her conclusion in the hearing that she held on the matter about whether to exclude Attorney Sprague was the claim that this was a stale issue because these assets had been an issue in the post-divorce proceeding back in prior to 2015. Apparently, Roger Matea, in this case, in the three cases that were filed, one of which was probate, one was chancery, and the third was miscellaneous remedies, apparently he thought it was important enough because he sent out a request to produce interrogatories regarding those same assets that were at issue in the post-divorce judgment matter under Section 513. Not only that, but in the deposition that he took of Bruce prior to the hearing in this matter, he also addressed in great detail those same assets. The short of it is the assets still existed and were intact in 2019 when the cases were filed and when he took Bruce's deposition, as they were back in 2015 when this all started. One of the cases that the appellee brings up with regard to all of this seems to indicate that, well, this is the same type of situation as it was in First National Bank of Elgin v. St. Charles National Bank. In his brief, appellee says, well, these we have almost identical facts. Well, that's not true. In the case that they cite, First National Bank v. St. Charles National Bank, the court specifically found that the previous assets in the prior case were outdated or superseded. Well, that was not the situation in this particular case. Here, Bruce's assets were still of issue. They were still yet to be determined whether they should be Bruce's assets or his mother's assets. Remember, part of this is a probate case, and we're talking about the death of their mother, Wanda. This is the death of Wanda. She has two sons, one of which is Bruce. The other is Roger. Roger has two children, one of which is Justin. The other one is Julia. That's the parties in the case. So with respect to that, I submit that the two cases are substantially related in that respect. With respect to the extent of Sprague's involvement in the prior case, Bruce filed an addendum to the motion to exclude Attorney Sprague in August of 2021, shortly before the hearing in this matter. In that addendum, he details not only what I just described with respect to the interrogatories and the depositions that he was subjected to, not only does he detail those things, he also details in there the extent of Attorney Sprague's involvement in his post-divorce action. And in that, he states that there were both meetings and phone calls with Attorney Sprague through Justin. If there be any question in this matter, the interests of Roger Mateo and the interests of Justin Mateo are aligned. And that was even the source of a subject of an interrogatory that Roger answered with respect to that. So at least Roger felt the issues were the same. At least Roger believed that the post-divorce assets were still relevant in the case. So once there's a substantial relationship, then the court moves to the next issues, and that is, what information was disclosed? This is where the S.K. Handtool case that I cited in the brief comes into play. In S.K. Handtool, the court specifically stated, once that link is established, once you have a substantial relationship between the prior litigation and the current litigation, then there's a presumption that the client disclosed confidential information to the attorney during the prior representation. One of the things Judge Katz found in her decision ruling against Bruce on this matter said, well, these are public matters now. Once the post-divorce Section 513 non-minor education expense case was concluded, those things were filed in a public forum. Well, that ignores the fact that much more than what is in the actual record is told to a client. There are notes, there are discussions, there's many things that would not be public knowledge. If that were the case, if that were the standard, it would negate any potential motion for disqualification of an attorney because everything after the first case is over would be in the public record, except for the notes, the discussions, the things that we're talking about here. So the standard that the court used in this particular case is not really appropriate when you take into consideration that there are private discussions that clients have with their attorney that can form the basis of that. And his Kahan tool addresses this head on. It says, first of all, and I quoted this in my brief, accordingly, any doubts as to the existence of a conflict should be resolved in favor of disqualification. So if it looks like that it should be a disqualification, any doubt should be resulted in favor of disqualifying the prior attorney. And that ties back into the whole purpose behind the statute, behind the rule with respect to disqualification. And that is to address what I said about what the court is looking for. They're looking at the issues of the attorney-client relationship maintaining public confidence in the legal profession and ensuring the integrity of the judicial proceedings. That's what Clem had to say about all this. Well, how is that advanced when you have a situation where you have more than the appearance of impropriety, but actual discussions between a client and the attorney, and then that attorney represents the opposing party in the case later on down the road, a separate action? How is that advanced? It's not. You have to take those two into competing consideration.
For the sake of time, I'd really like to hear about the other issues in this matter, too.
Okay.
It's not that I'm not suggesting that issue is important. I'm just saying that at the heart of this, I believe, is whether there was a settlement agreement or not. And I'd really like to hear from you on that issue.
So let me turn to the release then. This release was an integral part of the agreement between Bruce Mateo and Justin Mateo. There were problems that Justin had done in the way of extrajudicial proceedings with regard to Bruce. And he wanted those taken care of. That's why he insisted in the mediation, he insisted upon not just a standard or a general or ordinary or customary release, which is what Attorney Sprague argued on behalf of Justin when they didn't even show up at the mediation. Not that, but a specific global, complete, and full release. And Bruce typed that up and asked that be entered. And the one person who was objecting to that was Justin with respect to the particular release that Bruce drafted. The question becomes twofold. First of all, was Roger really eligible to sign on Justin's behalf and agree to a global, complete, and full release when he comes in after the fact and argues to Judge Katz, well, we don't even need a release. In fact, if we need a release, it should just be a general release or an ordinary release. He made those arguments specifically to Judge Katz. So he's not of the same mindset, even though Roger supposedly signed on behalf of Bruce on behalf of Justin with respect to an agreement at the time of the mediation.
Just a minute ago, you argued or said that, and I wrote it down, Roger and Justin's interests are aligned.
Yes.
Are their interests aligned or are they not aligned?
In the answer to the interrogatories, Roger stated that Justin's and his interests were aligned, and that's the extent of what I can tell you with regard to that. So they had an alignment of interests to some degree, but here's the thing. If they were aligned, then why did Justin come in after the fact and say, well, I don't agree to this global, complete, and full release? I think it should just be a standard release. I think it should be an ordinary or customary release. That language is in the transcript to Judge Katz during the course of that argument.
Did Justin ever dispute that all three claims had been fully resolved with mediation? Did he ever dispute that point?
He did not, but he marginalized the release as the part of it.
The language of the release.
Yes. It was all about the language of the release. Bruce was adamant about the language of the release. Justin was less than adamant about it. In fact, he tried to marginalize it, say, if the release has not been important. So here's the thing. The reason why, this is the key, the reason why Bruce was so adamant about the release is because he had been reported to various entities to include the ARDC with respect to allegations by Justin. So he wanted Justin to give up any more of those sorts of activities on his part, because it's not that he had been found guilty of anything, but he had to respond to all of the things that Justin put in there. So that was the issue with respect to why the release was so critical. And if the release is not important at all, then what is the point of having the language in there about having a global, complete, and full release?
Just to be clear from a timeline standpoint, the motion to disqualify counsel was filed prior to mediation. Is that correct?
Just prior.
Prior.
After the order was entered saying you guys are ordered to go to mediation, but before the mediation was scheduled. So it came in that window of time frame. That's when the motion was filed. And then the addendum was filed in August of 2021. And the addendum lays out all this information.
But the motion was pending at the time the parties reportedly or allegedly reached a full agreement of all claims.
Correct.
Is that right?
That's correct. Yes.
Attorney Gallagher, let me ask you this for clarification. Doesn't the mediated settlement agreement in paragraph 6 says that specifically, it mentions any and all other claims that either party might have against each other through this date. So doesn't that put an end line on what is anticipated to be in the release?
And it also goes on to say, though, that the parties agreed to a full, complete, global release. And Judge Katz found to be executed and entered into by the parties after the fact. So, yes, it does say that in here. You're right.
Doesn't that work against Bruce Mattea's argument that there were actions after this date that he wanted included in a release?
Well, his argument was that he would be the one, he would type up the release, it would be full, complete, and global, which is more than a standard or customary release, and it would have additional provisions, so he did. I mean, his argument is that it includes much more than what, this is a parameter, a framework for what the release is supposed to say, but he wanted more detail than that in it.
Details that resulted from occurrences after the date that was closed by the settlement agreement.
I'm sorry.
Details from occurrences that were after the date closed by the settlement agreement.
Yeah, any and all claims that either party may have against each other through this date, whether known or unknown, whether or not matured. So he wanted Bruce to, he wanted Justin to stop making allegations based on the past relationship that the two had had. Justin had worked in Bruce's office for 15 years. So that was part of what he wanted to cut off at the knees. Thank you. I see my time's up.
Any further questions?
No, thank you.
All right, you'll have time on rebuttal. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Stephen, if you would state your name for the record when you approach. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Wayne Skeegan for the appellee, Justin Mattea. May it please the court, counsel. I'm going to begin by talking about the settlement issue. The position proffered by Bruce regarding whether or not there was a settlement is inconsistent with the facts, and it's frankly disingenuous because Bruce recognized, agreed, and knew all along that he had reached a settlement with Roger, with Justin, and with Julia. It was clear from his counsel's words to the court, from his words to counsel, and from what Bruce circulated among the parties. What Bruce circulated was a proposed formal settlement agreement following the execution of the MSA, the mediated settlement agreement. That included a global mutual release. The MSA included a global mutual release. Bruce's proper settlement agreement included a mutual release, but Bruce's agreement included much more than that, and that's what led to that document being unacceptable to the appellees, and in particular to Justin. But Bruce clearly recognized that he had an agreement with Justin and Julia, notwithstanding that they weren't present at the mediation and that Roger was there on their behalf. He prepared a settlement agreement and circulated it with their signatures on it. The release that he signed, or the MSA, the mediated settlement agreement, that Bruce signed at the time of the mediation said that everybody's releasing everybody of all claims, you know, a global release, including claims by Justin and Julia. So Bruce knew and understood and agreed that Justin and Julia were parties to this settlement, and he acted in accordance. And his counsel, some weeks later after the mediation, told the other counsel in writing, and it's in the record, that we settled this case 10 weeks ago. And then on the hearing on the motion to enforce the settlement in October 2021, Bruce's attorney, Mr. Babb, in answering questions from Judge Katz, said, nobody's repudiating any of the terms of the mediated settlement agreement. We understand them. Nobody's repudiating them. They are the terms of the settlement. So, Bruce.
Mr. Gruninger spent quite a bit of time in the beginning arguing the motion to disqualify, and that motion, as we understand, was filed prior to the mediated settlement. The mediated settlement agreement, I believe, included language that all matters and claims in each of these cases are resolved. My question is this. Is it your position that it resolved the motion to disqualify at that time or not?
It's our position that the settlement of the case eliminated all issues, including disqualification. And as set forth in our appellee's brief, the settlement agreement took care of the disqualification issue. There was no carve-out in the MSA for this issue. Bruce didn't condition his settlement on some overturning of the disqualification issue. The motion to enforce the settlement, both orders enforcing the settlement, the one in October of 2021 and the one in March of 2025, came after the disqualification motion was denied. But Bruce also didn't even identify the order denying the disqualification motion in his notice of appeal. The notice of appeal identified the orders on the enforcing the settlement and said any, and it also, we're also appealing any orders that relate back to the orders on the enforcement of the settlement. Well, the order denying disqualification came before the orders enforcing the settlement. So that disqualification denial can't relate back to the orders enforcing the settlement. So frankly, our position is that Bruce did not effectively preserve appellate review of the disqualification denial. He didn't include it in the notice of appeal. But in any event, it's like with other interlocutory order situations. I could bring the plaintiff could bring a claim for breach of contract and fraud, and his fraud claim could be dismissed on a motion to dismiss. They're proceeding on the contract claim. Then they settle. Then they have a global settlement, and the case is over. That plaintiff then can't appeal the denial of his fraud claim. The case is over. And all three of these cases are over. And the signed MSA is very clear that all claims in all three of these cases are resolved and all the matters have been resolved by settlement.
So aside from your argument that this issue is not even preserved on appeal, if we agree with your contention that this mediated settlement agreement was enforceable as of the date of mediation, then we do not even need to address the motion to disqualify. Is that what you're arguing here?
That is our argument. I mean, you know, in excess of cautiousness, I have also addressed the merits of the disqualification issue. But I think the court need not reach that issue because of the binding and enforceable settlement. Contrary to what is alleged in appellant's papers and argument, Justin and Julia and Roger, none of the appellees ever repudiated any of the terms of the MSA, and in particular, the notion of the requisite release. Mr. Gruninger argued that, well, this wasn't going to be just any ordinary release. This was a expansive release. I'm not quoting him, but that was the sentiment he was conveying. Well, paragraph 6 of the MSA is that type of language. You can have a release where the parties settle and say, we're releasing only this claim. That is very unusual. I think the court recognized generally when people settle, they want to buy peace, and they settle and release all claims, known or unknown, of any type whatsoever that may have existed as of the time of the execution or the entry of this settlement. That's what paragraph 6 of the MSA calls for. That's what all of the appellees embraced. None of them disagreed with that notion. The settlement, counter-settlement proposal that, or counter-form of agreement that was conveyed or circulated by Justin after the mediation included that same language, that same global mutual release language. Bruce's proffered form of agreement included that language, which would have been fine. The reason this case didn't get resolved and the reason litigation has continued to today is because Bruce added an additional term in his proffered agreement. He said, everybody is to acknowledge, and he said this over and over again in various parts of what he circulated, everybody's acknowledging that every claim and allegation we've ever made about anybody else was baseless. That's not a release. Nobody, no settlement agreement includes that language. That's not what a release is. A release is, we give up all our claims, known or unknown, of any kind whatsoever, as of this date. And then you say, but I'm not admitting liability. That's a release. A release saying everything I ever said about you was frivolous or baseless, that's not part of a release. So that language that Bruce wanted the parties to agree to after the mediation is nowhere in the MSA. It's not what the parties signed at the mediation. So Bruce tried to add that term, and that's why the case didn't settle. But it's not the case that any of the appellees repudiated the terms of the MSA or disagreed with the notion that there should be a binding mutual global release. Notably, in the reply papers from the appellant, there was no quibble with the case law that appellees submitted, that Illinois law has been clear for decades that where the parties may contemplate and expressly say we're going to have a formal settlement agreement executed, that there can be a settlement, there still can be a settlement and a binding settlement even if that agreement is, that formal agreement is not signed, as long as they first agree to all of the essential terms of the settlement and more importantly do not condition their settlement on the execution of that formal settlement agreement. Illinois law is absolutely clear on that, that as long as the execution of the document, the formal document, is not a conditioned precedent for an enforceable settlement, then there can be a settlement if there's a meeting of the minds as to all the essential terms of the settlement. The MSA, the mediated settlement agreement, specifically says these are all of the essential terms of the settlement. It does not say, but there's no settlement unless we sign a formal agreement. It does just the opposite.
Back to the status of Justin and Juliet as well, were there any substantive claims asserted against them?
There were not.
Did they assert any substantive claims against anyone?
They did not.
So they were just nominal parties in the 17MR384 action?
Correct.
So they weren't releasing anything essentially pertaining to these claims?
They, over time, as Mr. Grunier pointed out, Justin had made various allegations, and I think everybody wanted to buy peace, as is the case when you spend that much time trying to settle a case.
But at least as it pertains to the issues pending in the litigation,
but I think it was there was, they would have had some interest in the property being adjudicated in a probate matter, but there were no claims of, like, say, breach of fiduciary duty like there were between Roger and Bruce. But Illinois is clear that there did not need to be an executed formal agreement for there to be a binding settlement agreement here. Many of the cases, such as Haller, which is a Fifth District case, Lorton, Lampe, Glassman, many of those are based on oral agreements. And the court still said, yeah, there was a meeting of the minds, and yeah, the parties planned to have a formal settlement agreement executed, but that formal settlement agreement was not a condition precedent for the settlement to become enforceable and binding. And that's the situation here. And our case is even stronger because we have a signed MSA that include all of the essential terms, including the all-important mutual global release that nobody on the appellee side ever repudiated. As I said at the outset, the fact that Julia and Justin were not physically present at the mediation does not mean that they repudiated or were not parties to the settlement. Roger signed the MSA on their behalf, and consistently thereafter, their counsel affirmed that they were in agreement with those terms, that Roger was authorized to sign on their behalf. They ratified that signature over and over again. They never departed from their position that this was a binding settlement and that they adopted and agreed to all of the terms in the MSA. Roger's counsel, who at one point suggested, well, Bruce's form is okay, then in court, speaking before Judge Katz, he said, now that I read it more carefully and I saw it had this additional language that Bruce added, can't have that. That's what's holding us up. So it wasn't just Justin who objected to that language. Roger, through his counsel, did likewise. So on that issue, the circuit court, both Judge Katz and Judge Campbell, correctly, under the manifest weight of the evidence standard, or frankly under any standard, found that the parties had reached a settlement agreement and that that settlement agreement is binding. May I ask how much time I have when the yellow light starts?
Madam Clerk.
Okay, thank you. Let me turn briefly to the disqualification issue, although I think I've said my main position I want to convey to the court is that the court need not reach that issue because you have a binding settlement that disposed of everything. And it wasn't preserved for appeal effectively because of the deficiency of the notice of appeal. On the merits of it, the standard is abuse of discretion, and we submit that the circuit court did not abuse its discretion on this issue because there was such a paltry showing of any relationship whatsoever between the fleeting 2009 discussions between Justin and Attorney Sprague, and Attorney Sprague's later representation of Justin in the three actions below. The fact that Bruce's assets, to some extent, may be implicated in his post-divorce proceedings relating to the education costs of his son and his ex-wife's son, and his assets may also be affected by the probate and other proceedings 9 years later, that doesn't create a substantial relationship. And that the First National case does talk about the fact that there's common assets in play in two separate lawsuits that are years apart doesn't mean the cases themselves are substantially related. There's no overlap among the transactions or the legal issues, and no suggestion whatsoever that confidential information was imparted. And Mr. Sprague did submit an affidavit saying, I have no information from Bruce Matea, and I see my time has run.
Any questions?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Brunberg, you'll have time on rebuttal.
Pelley argues that the fact that they went through mediation and purportedly came to an agreement eliminated the attorney disqualification issue. On page 35 of Pelley's brief, he makes that argument but cites no case law in support of the argument that the issue of attorney disqualification is waived upon coming to an agreement.
But isn't it moot? I mean, is it relevant at that point in time if you have a full and global settlement?
Well, I think it's not, only because of the reasons why attorney disqualification is so important to the court in the first place, as it's laid out. In the case law that I cited.
I understand, but as it relates to this case, though.
Well, there's two competing interests, and of course, one of them is the appearance of the court to the public. And that is an important competing interest. And so if it's a situation where you have an attorney who is representing, who has previously represented one side and then represents the other side in an action, I think
I'm just not sure what appearance it gives when they reach a settlement that they sign in mediation.
Well, and that's what I think it has to be weighed by the court. At the time the attorney disqualification issue came in front of Judge Katz, and there's no weighing of that. She never addressed that issue. She simply stated, and she used some of the bases of being, it's a stale claim, the previous representation. It's something that is no longer in effect. And that, I mean, the second one is certainly not true because it was still in effect.
I also don't understand how it impacts the settlement. So I'm more focused on the settlement agreement.
Okay. So from Bruce's perspective, the release is key. This isn't a situation, and he wouldn't be appealing this if it was just a normal general release, because everybody signs a general release. But this release was most important thing to him, and that's because of the history between himself and Justin. So the fact that it was a very specific, global, complete, full release meant everything in purposes of settling with regard to this.
So shouldn't that have been part of the mediated settlement agreement, though, the order that the agreement that he ultimately signed, if it was so important to him, wouldn't that term have been part of that underlying signed document?
I think that's what he expected paragraph 6 to do for him. Hereby releasing the parties agree to a full, complete, and global release of all claims that they may have against each other. And paragraph 1 says, parties will enter a more formal and complete settlement document and release. So, I mean, you know, I think he thought that's exactly what paragraphs 1 and 6 would both together, put together, would do for him in that regard. Because, as I indicated, that was the most important part to it. One of the things, though, I want to point out is this case was acrimonious from the beginning between Roger and Bruce, brothers, if you will. When Roger files a petition, and I put this in my brief on page 12 at the very top, when Roger initially started the probate case, he filed a petition for citation to discover and recover assets alleging conversion by Bruce. So that's what started all this acrimony between the parties to begin with. And then, of course, prior to that, Justin had left working for Bruce and gone out on his own, so there was no good blood there either. So
I get back this motion to disqualify. It was filed before mediation, so they go to mediation. And if your client felt strongly about this motion to disqualify, why couldn't he have simply said, I refuse to settle these claims until I have that motion heard?
Until the motion to disqualify
is heard. Yes, it's heard and decided. Why do you have that option, that ability?
And in retrospect, it probably should have done just that. If I filed a motion to disqualify, I want it heard promptly. But that didn't happen in this case. It didn't become an issue until right after after the order, parties were ordered to mediation. That's when Justin hired his new attorney, Attorney Sprague. It was after they were ordered to mediation. That's when he filed it. That's when he filed the initial motion. And then the motion wasn't heard until September of 2021. So that's the timing on everything.
Any other questions?
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you both for your arguments. We will take this matter under advisement. We will issue a ruling in due course. Have a great rest of your day. We're going to take a brief recess, and we should be back in about 15 minutes. So, thank you.
All rise.